Yeah, I think online dating can work if there's something really specific that you're looking for. So, like, if you were vegan and that was a big deal for you.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, like, into tickling. Ahoy there, mateys! Welcome to another spectacular episode of The Sophisticates. I'm Matt Patches, and I'm once again joined by my compatriots, Rajan Mudambi, who I believe is now a resident of America's largest parish, Boston.
Yes, I am, indeed.
How is it? Weather nice?
Well, it has rained the entire time I've been here. I don't know if that's Boston's fault or just...
I think that's life in general. And of course, we also have Ryan Pfister.
Greetings from Pittsburgh, resident of our location of Pittsburgh Ease, I have learned.
What is that?
It's the language of Pittsburgh.
I'm pretty sure it's almost the same, except they say pop. So there.
No, there's also a lot of... There's yiz.
Oh, God. That makes the Philadelphian in me shiver with fear. today's episode is actually very special because the Sophisticates are proud to welcome a guest for the first time to the show, a good friend of all of ours, Elaine Hughes. Elaine, tell us, give us the one-liner, who you are, kind of brief explanation.
Sure. I work in public relations in Philadelphia, and I live in New Jersey, but I try not to... talk about that.
Oh, wait. So are you in New Jersey right now?
Yes.
Oh, so we are spanning four different states. Bravo, everybody. Let's get on with it. And we have three amazing topics today, some of them courtesy of our guest, Elaine. So we'll dive right in. Our first topic for today, Twitter insurance. Now, Elaine, give us the rundown here, because this is kind of a new development, and you probably are the expert.
Yeah, sure. This is something that's coming up on the horizon. Basically, some insurance companies are seeing an increase of legal actions that are resulting from interactions on Facebook and Twitter, and they're starting to underwrite policies for companies that want to insure themselves against damage to their brands and that can be caused through social media. So, and in about 5 years, they think it'll be available to the average consumer as well.
But what I don't understand about this is how, like, they can go about proving that they've been damaged by people's comments. That's the problem with everything on the internet, I guess. It's all so gray. It's so murky.
Well, you can prove a drop in sales.
Right, but you can't directly link it to anything.
I mean, you can, if you lose sales in for a particular product as soon as this happens, I think you can. I mean, you can quantify your loss.
Now this is people say something bad about your brand on Twitter, and then your sales drop, and so the insurance company pays you money.
That's kind of how I'm thinking it's going to work. I think the details are still kind of in the works. But yeah, it's basically to protect your brand. So, like, sometimes things will happen where people will create these fake Twitter handles for a brand.
Right.
And there's some, you know, that's kind of a mockery and there's some damage done to it. Or there have been some cases where a group will just rally against, you know, what happened with Nestle's, where Greenpeace just rallied against them and posted all kinds of negative things on their Facebook account. And so I think that, you know, it's just kind of something that's kind of coming up on the horizon that you could purchase insurance to insure yourself against legal actions that might result from something that happened on a social media account.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with, like, slander law, but it doesn't seem like being against something and speaking out against it is unfair, unlawful. I mean, isn't that my right to be able to speak against these things? It reminds me of when burglars or something crash through the window of the place that they're trying to steal shit from, and then they sue the company in some respects. It just seems they just want the money. They need someone to point fingers at. It seems too ambiguous to ever really take off.
Well, just to clarify here on the side, does that actually happen in real life, or did that only happen on Liar Liar?
What, burglars who...
Yes.
No, that happens in real life.
Okay, I'll accept it.
Working with a lot of the movie studios and following them on Twitter and seeing what's going on, there's a lot of spoof accounts that make fun of them, and it's really fun because it's just hilarious to have another voice behind them mocking what they do. But that's mockery, that's spoof, that's totally 100% legal. Do you think this could ever really take off? I don't think so.
Well, think about it this way. What is, say your brand was more of like a personality base, so say maybe
like
you
mine.
Were Yeah, say maybe you had like a really conservative personality base, and then somebody posted something on Twitter that undermined that you had been out doing drugs, or you know, maybe posted a picture of you or something, and then you were no longer able to work. Maybe you were no longer able to do speaking functions, or maybe your show got canceled that you had, or you lost a lot of your followers. That could be something that would.
They're taking the fun away from social media.
Negative action from social media.
What makes Twitter special here? Like, what if somebody just made fun of you, like, in person?
Right, it's the same thing. Casual poking fun.
Twitter has a larger, you can reach more people.
Well, see, in defamation, I'm not a lawyer, but in defamation law, you have to be able to prove malicious intent to bring a suit and to win. So basically, like, you know, if, you know, Matt and Ryan are over in the corner talking, maybe Matt makes a joke that's defaming. He meant it as a joke. It, you know, no big deal. But if somebody posts something on social media, you know, you basically have the intent to hurt somebody.
Why is there 100% intent?
Because it's like, I mean, it's, well, I mean, maybe not, but you know, maybe that's ambiguous, but it's more provable than it being said aloud.
Because I make fun of a lot of people on Twitter. So I have something personal invested in this argument.
Like, why don't you just sue instead of getting the insurance? I guess maybe there's not a guarantee.
I feel like probably, I don't know, maybe this is not correct, but I feel like it's kind of for those cases where you can't sue, yet your brand is still affected. Like, if you can sue and get, you know, defamation money from them, then you don't really need the insurance. Protecting yourself from something where the law can't protect you.
Well, here's my concern, is that if you're a brand, I feel like if you have to buy Twitter insurance, you're kind of capitulating that you suck at Twitter.
Yeah, totally. Like... you don't get Twitter. You do not get social media. You don't understand how the dynamic of this new age works, and suddenly you feel like you need the backup just in case you suck so hard that people are going to slander you over the interweb, and yeah, you're making a fool of yourself. Anyone who gets Twitter insurance needs to go home.
Well, it's about being like, the whole point of Twitter, part of being Twitter is like to be cool in the eyes of people.
Yeah, and Twitter insurance is the dorkiest thing you can get.
However, there's another side. I don't know if this is actually being proposed or not, but another sort of thing on Twitter that you could insure is if you are that person saying these kind of controversial things, and then someone does sue you.
Insure yourself to be a clown?
Yeah, I think that'd be cool.
Doesn't most insurance come from, like, you're insured for things that happen by accident? Medical insurance, I get sick. Home insurance, a tornado blows my house down. This sounds just like insurance against your own stupidity.
I mean, newspapers have that, have liability insurance. You write something that gets you,
right,
that gets you sued, and depending on how the contract is written, the insurance company will pay some of the cost of the judgment.
Elaine, do you find that people, I don't know if your workings in the PR world have shown you this or not, but do you think that there are companies who are making the kind of mistakes on Twitter that would, or Facebook or whatever, that would need this? I mean,
I don't know, that's pretty, it's up in the air, but there have been some instances where, you know, things kind of spontaneously happen on social media, like with Nestle, where Greenpeace went on a tirade about where they were getting some of their things that they were using to manufacture products and just started posting all over their wall.
But isn't that fair? That sounds fair to me. That sounds like what we're allowed to do as a society, bring companies we don't like down.
Well, this is not an issue of fairness. This is an issue of does Nestle need protection?
Yeah, exactly. But, and you're allowed to say your mind and stuff, but not really in a defamatory way, not in a way that significantly is out to damage somebody else's reputation.
But why not? if someone's doing something horrible or you have a strong opinion against them, you want to speak out against it, so you do. And we shouldn't be insuring people, or people shouldn't be allowed to be insured for something like that, because the whole point of me being against them making these statements is to bring them down in some respect. I'm protesting them. They shouldn't be able to get a backup. That sounds crazy.
Yeah, but it's not guaranteed. Like, social media, nobody is fact-checking people for saying things on Twitter. So people might be saying horrible things about you that aren't true, but aren't necessarily simple to disprove.
Fair enough.
And that's very damaging, potentially.
No, everything on the internet is true, Rajan. Shut up.
Well, so here's the question. Like, if you're this company and you're trying to, what should Nestle's proper response be if they want to stay cool on Twitter? Maybe you could create a fake. You should buy a fake Greenpeace.
Yeah, you should start like dark Greenpeace.
Yellow piece.
I'm pretty sure that's what you're not supposed to do. That'd look really bad.
Well, that's a problem. The internet really is still bad. The wild, wild west in some respects, and it's there's no laws. And bringing Twitter insurance into it, I think, is just going to make it messier. It's not going to help either stop people from being accusatory, and it's not going to bring reason to the whole thing. It's just going to make things messier.
I mean, Matt, I think that you have a very moral view of insurance. like you know, you're.
I don't even know where that puts me politically, by the way.
I think it makes you a damn liberal. That's what I think
no.
it does.
Oh, well, I didn't think it was that far. Well, not.
Well, look, here's the thing. Like taking out insurance is kind of the opposite of doing a moral judgment here. This isn't saying whether it's like right or wrong. It's like, oh man, this might happen to us, and we don't think we're going to be able to sue for it, so we're going to be able to try to protect our losses instead. I think it's wimpy. I think it's the opposite of being balls out. If you're buying insurance like against a car accident, it's not really about being cool. I mean, maybe it is if you're trying to drive a really cool car, but in general, you're trying to get from point A to point B. Like, right. If you're on Twitter, the whole point of being on Twitter is like to seem hip
and to reach a lot of people and to have a voice.
Right, to build a following.
Yeah, to have a voice,
yeah,
to be a personality.
A
and even if you're a company, like, that's the same thing.
Yeah, it is.
I think that let's put moral hazard here in that just because you have Twitter insurance doesn't mean you can stop trying to be cool.
That's very fair. All right, well, moving on, let's get to our second topic for today. Profiling people when asking for help.
I was sitting at a Starbucks and outside, and the woman next to me had a bag, and she stood up to go to the bathroom and said, "Hey, can you watch my bag?" I said, "Sure." But as I sat there, I was like, you know, I'm a complete stranger. You have no idea that I'm not going to take your bag. You know, so I was just like, why would you ask a stranger?
Yeah, when I studied abroad in Europe, they were much less lax about that kind of stuff than we are here in the States. Like, even in church, like, you did not leave a bag in a pew. Like, at the grocery store, you did not leave your bag in the cart while you went over two aisles. Like,
what, just the paranoia there is so much?
No, it's just petty theft is so much more common there. Right. And pickpocketing. I think here in the States, we're much more relaxed, much more complacent on a daily basis.
I don't know. I'm scared to leave anything around. Maybe that's like a New York thing. But Ryan, so you think that you were profiled in some way. Like, why?
Yeah.
Why can they reasonably leave something in your possession for a matter of seconds? You could be a thief. Even a gangly blonde dude like you could steal things.
Oh, easily I could still be a thief. But that's what I'm wondering is if people do profile when they're picking somebody to watch their stuff.
I think definitely there are people do profile when they ask people to watch their stuff. And I think in general, they probably pick people who are more similar to them.
That makes sense. So it's not, we won't put all the blame on like white people profiling minorities or something, because it's similar to any color creed looking for similar people to hold onto their stuff, because for some reason the other types of people will commit nefarious acts against them.
I don't even know if it's because you're consciously thinking, oh, I think these other people are going to steal from me. I think people are intrinsically, I've heard the word tribalism, which is, as opposed to like racism, where it's not are prejudicial towards other races, you just kind of apparently drawn to your own
way. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. Lest we get too heavy here, I guess I'm wondering if, is there anyone that could you ever trust a stranger to watch your stuff? Like, if you had a rather long conversation with them? Or
Well, I mean, this woman obviously trusted you. Do you not feel like you can trust your fellow man in that same way?
Wait, Mister, how big was the bag? Was it like a suitcase?
Yeah, what are we talking
about? Or was it a small purse? Or
it was like a bag purse, not like a clutch, like a bag purse.
That's weird. Why didn't she take it with her?
Well, I mean, I guess that is weird, but
the point is, Fister, you felt uncomfortable being in that position.
No, I was fun. Well, I did.
You
well,
did because
I
you
did
were like,
note,
why is this even
that?
Happening?
But I guess my main concern was like, I don't feel like I would do the same thing. I always, pretty much always take my bag. And I don't know if I should be a more trusting person.
Now, see, I know a lot of girls that when they go out and they take big purses and they get tired of carrying them, and then they've tried to get guys to hold them for them while they're at bars or clubs.
Random guys?
But not usually random guys. It's usually somebody in the group.
Right. But we can't trust our fellow man enough. There's too much paranoia. There's too much pre-existing crime to be able to kind of have someone look after your stuff normally.
Well, so here's the other part of that is if you're a person, I guess it's kind of hard to put yourself in the mind of a thief, but if you're somebody who might steal a bag and but the person specifically asks you to watch their stuff, are you less likely to steal it? In other words, if you're going to leave your bag with a stranger, is it a good idea to tell them to watch my bag?
So you lower the possibility of a crime because you now know who would have committed it.
Well, because there's two ends. It's one, you're telling the person that you're leaving. So you're either handing them on a silver platter a chance to steal the bag, but on the other hand, you're telling them that they expect you to watch the bag.
Yeah, and they know who you are. So if they stole it or something, you would know exactly who it is.
But you're a stranger still.
Yeah. You could steal something out of the bag. You don't have to steal the whole bag. You could just steal the money out of it, or you could have stolen her ID and sold it.
I like that this
she might not have known.
I like that this has become not like, would you trust people? It's how to steal things when people kindly ask you to watch something.
I mean, the thing that troubles me about this story is the task. Because, see, like, now me, if I was looking for someone to hold my bag, I'd probably look for another girl. But for a different
task, I might
be more likely... But for another task, I might be more likely to try and get a male. Like, if there was something wrong with my car and I needed help, I think I'd be more likely to try to approach, you know, some random male nearby. Or if I needed directions, I'm not sure. I might be more likely to pick a guy than a girl. I think what bothers me is that it was a girl trying to leave the bag with another guy that I find weird, because I would probably never try to leave my bag with a random guy.
Now, this is kind of what Ranja was talking about, and it's fascinating, because you're looking for specific types of people to help you with specific tasks. Like, is it because girls carry purses, so this girl should be able to watch your purse?
Yeah, and she probably, you know, understands that you get tired of carrying it around, but... I don't understand why, if she was just going to the bathroom, I don't understand why she shouldn't take it with her, because there's usually, like, hooks in the bathroom, and you can just hang it.
But, I mean, it could...
The
situation lends itself to a variety of objects or situations. Like you said, if someone needed to watch your car, or if you needed directions, suddenly there's some sort of double standard where you feel like you can't ask specific people. And it's not necessarily a trust thing, though, is it? It's just like, you know how to watch my purse. You know how to watch my car.
Well, and she's probably judging you less. Like if it was a guy, I guess you could potentially think the guy might be annoyed by watching the purse, but the girl might be more understanding.
You know, we were talking about like racist profiling earlier, but it really has nothing to do with that. It's just kind of an inherent connection to people.
Yeah, maybe it's based on annoying them less.
Yeah.
I think you used the perfect word there. There has to be some sort of connection. Because if you have the connection, that like once you've made a connection with someone, you kind of feel like they're less likely to steal.
So I guess that here's the question. If you're leaving the purse, should you tell the person to watch the purse?
I think you have to interact with them. You have to acknowledge and go an extra step. You can't just say, hey, can you watch this and walk away? You have to make sure that they know who you are in some capacity. Like, show them who you are through conversation, short conversation, and acknowledge that you know who they are. And then you should be fine.
Well, how about this? So if somebody just left their bag and, like, went to the bathroom and didn't talk to you, and then somebody else came up and tried to take the purse, would you say anything?
Yes, I would.
Yes, I would say something too.
So does actually asking somebody to watch the purse even help?
It helps you, not me.
I think there is a responsibility connected to it, because I think if someone just put their bag down next to me, I think I would feel like the expectation was lower on my part than if someone actually asked me to watch their bag. Then I would feel a sort of responsibility.
You have to be on the lookout
task.
Now.
Yeah.
Maybe what we need is insurance here. Like if you ask somebody to watch your bag and they're not trustworthy.
That's what wimps do. Wimps take out insurance for their purses. On that note, why don't we move on to our final topic for today, the context of dating.
For a little while, I kind of dabbled in online dating a little bit, but I never really got excited about anybody that I met that way. But when I found that whenever I met somebody just through friends or incidentally, I got much more like enthused about going on a date with them. And so I guess I was just wondering, like, how much does it matter how you meet someone into how long you might date or whether you might be more into that relationship?
Someone, you were saying that you were more enthused by people you just randomly met in the real world?
Yeah. Yeah.
Online dating seems like a great way of meeting people, but when you actually end up going on the date, it's kind of like, well, we're here because of online dating and we forced ourselves to go on this date, as opposed to something that organically comes together.
Yeah. I think it's also that when you meet someone in real life, there's a certain chemistry that you feel right away. And then I think because you have that chemistry, you can kind of overlook some of the minor faults in people. Whereas I think with online dating, sometimes you almost know their faults right up front. Or maybe there's things you're not so sure about that you saw.
But isn't that
the
whole point, that you're supposed to be able to look at like what they like and what they do for a living and the way that they write those profiles? Like, that's supposed to give you an indication if you have chemistry. It's like before you even have to go on an awkward date and find someone that you don't actually like, you get to peruse these people and decide who to go on a date with. It seems like you should have more chemistry. It should go better.
Yeah, but the difference is you go into the date knowing a lot more than maybe someone you just met briefly.
Perhaps remove some of the mystique of that first date.
Oh, there's no discovery.
I mean, for me, I think it's like I think people like subconsciously want to believe in fate in their relationships.
Totally.
And there's pretty much no fate with an online relationship. Like, you could believe that you happen to scroll across their profile, but that's pretty much the extent of it. Like you can, in the real world, you're much more likely to come across something that's truly random.
I don't look for someone who's exactly like me. And I think that's how online dating works. It's like, you're paired with these people because you have similar interests and you've answered these questions all correctly. And it's very clinical. And
yeah, I think online dating can work if there's something really specific that you're looking for that you might not be able to find any other way. So, like, if you were vegan and that was a big deal for you.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, like, into tickling or...
or if you lived, you know, in a small town somewhere where was a lot of diversity and you really wanted to find someone who was Indian, you might be able to find, like, the only other Indian person within 50 miles that way.
That sounds like profiling to me, but...
Isn't that what it is? You're profiling people based on their interests and their attributes?
This makes me think that we need to use online dating to find people to watch our purses.
That's what I was saying. But in defense of online dating, I mean, I feel like it could be used to do the sort of things that we're talking about in real life. Like, there isn't really an online dating service that I know of that is all about the chance encounter, which seems like you could put that. I mean, that could work. There's actually a friend of mine works for a site called How About We. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but instead of it being, I mean, you have a profile, you write some information about yourself, but it's mostly about finding dates through, you propose the date on the site and then people flock to that. It's all about what you guys want to do together. But of course, there's still that
profile.
So
you could be going on a date with multiple people?
No. You wouldn't, like, not group dating, but it's here's the, you know, let's go to this restaurant and have drinks, or let's walk around Central Park for the day, and people who are interested in that communicate with you. There's still a profile aspect to it, which I think is the drawback in some respects. Like, you don't want to know the information about the people. You just want to, like, maybe see who they are, and if they're interested in your date, then that's your common link, as opposed to, like, the scientific method of finding the right partner.
Well, I think that's a potential improvement, but you're still missing the element of meeting someone. I think it's actually most powerful when you meet someone when you're not trying to meet someone.
Yeah.
Right, the chance encounter. I mean, the crossing of paths.
I found that in my relationship, generally speaking...
In his legacy of womanizing.
Exactly. I generally end up getting together with someone when that was not remotely on my mind.
Yeah, but then you don't know what that person's intentions are. The other thing I think with online dating is like, here's what I want to do, date someone. And that's
true.
And that's where I think why people start flocking to online dating, why it came about in the first place. You know, Elaine, you mentioned when we were first talking about this, if it's a fad or not. I don't think it's something that's going to fade away.
I don't know. If you're ever on one of those sites, a lot of the people seem kind of embarrassed to be on there. Like,
right.
I remember I used to be on OkCupid, and one of the questions was, like, you know, something I wouldn't normally admit. And that was, like, one of the things. That's something almost everyone wrote, that I am on an online dating site. So I think there's a certain stigma to it.
Right. It's like an act of desperation.
Yeah. And I think there are a lot more people on online dating now, so that stigma is not as strong,
right.
But it is still there.
You know, our past episode, we talked about going to clubs and having a tough time actually interacting with people because everyone's really creeped out. And, like, going to bars, everyone is on alert. There's a paranoia. Everyone is worried about getting creeped on. And that seems to be taking away from, Ryan, what you've been saying. It's like the organic, the crossing of two people randomly. I don't know if that... I think that environment is disappearing.
Oh, maybe it's just disappearing in general, as opposed to people giving up on it. Like, maybe it's actually less... You're saying that it's not just that people have this other opportunity,
right.
Whereas they would just go without. You're saying that actually the opportunities for the chance encounters are lower nowadays than they used to be.
I would probably agree with that.
I don't know if the chance encounters are necessarily... If you go to some other location, maybe you're at a show, or maybe you're at, like, a coffee house, or, like, if you just randomly run into somebody somewhere else, like at the park maybe or something, then
I don't think that happens as much as you think it does. I don't think that's as appropriate.
No, I don't think,
appropriate anymore.
You don't think so?
Do you think you could in the past? Do you think you could, like, 20 years ago?
I think that you had to. I think that maybe the introduction of online dating has taken away from it so much that now, like, that's the appropriate place to do it, not here in person.
Oh, this is it. This is interesting because it's like it's almost like this vicious circle with the online dating, where people go on online dating, and then because people know that online dating is available, they're less receptive to, like, desperate people in person.
Right. So all of dating is actually dying. Because real-life dating is going away because people are too creeped out by meeting complete strangers and they're flocking to online dating. But everyone's so afraid of online dating that no one's going to talk to each other there. So all dating is going to cease to exist within, like, what, 2 years?
Well, like, this is my concern that, well, I think what is happening is that we have people, there's still these organic relationships happening. And then we have this, like, small sub-segment. Like people that would normally just go longer, you know, just go without a relationship and wait for one to come along are just jumping into an online dating one instead.
But I don't know if they're finding the success there.
Well, I mean, that's what's fascinating to me is it's like there's two, like, points of strength for a relationship, I think, on opposite poles here, is that you could have people that have a really good meeting story, and then you could also have people that have a lot of stuff incompatible that are where they're compatible with each other. And it's like, would you rather have somebody with a good meeting story that you're not really compatible with, or somebody that you're really compatible with but your meeting story is
I guess
so,
that's
so.
Why I guess there's so many different kinds of people, we have it all.
But do you think that because it's so easy to meet someone that way, people give up on those relationships sooner? Because they're like, okay, this didn't seem perfect, I can just find someone else.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. This is really, I mean, I think that online dating, it's almost like it cheapens, it really, like, raises the opportunity cost, I guess, maybe, of the relationships here. Because you know that you could try to jump into something else.
Right.
There's very much less sticking it out.
Risk management. You know what, actually, the dating scene needs? Insurance.
I was not going to go there.
Okay. We had to go there.
I'm not going
to
go there. Okay.
If you, like, break up with someone that you shouldn't have broken up with, and then it's, like, irreparably damaged.
Yes, I should be able to go back and either be compensated for that loss or get the girl back. That's what I'm thinking. On that note, I think we're wrapped up for today. So thanks very much again for listening. Elaine, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was fun.
Hopefully we can do it again soon. And Ryan, just very quickly, haircut. Did you get one?
Oh, I got it. More than that, I used a coupon on it. So it was only $10.
You clipped a coupon for a haircut? Where do you get your haircut?
Great Clips.
Oh, my God. How did it go? I mean, it looks good.
It
looks good.
It was fantastic.
Wow. All right. Great Clips. They're now a sponsor of the Sophisticates. So thank you very much to Great Clips for Ryan's wonderful haircut. Thanks again for listening. Check us out. Tumblr, SoundCloud, Twitter, all of the above. Leave comments. Ask questions. Be part of the discussion. And we will talk to you next week.
Yay.